Hello everyone. I'm Kim, your queer matchmaker. I use they, them pronouns, and I'm the creator of, among other things, A Whole Orange. And if you don't know, A Whole Orange provides queer singles / ready to mingles events, queer zine dating workshops, and a one-to-one queer matchmaking service with me. An official beginning. This is the third time I've tried to record this. And immediately after this, I have to leave. So hopefully we get it in one. Last episode, I was talking about reading Love in Exile by Sean Fay, and that's what this episode is about. I've decided just to write these episodes out and read them out, and then upload the written version to Substack. So if you want the written version, there it is for you. So here we go. As I'm writing this, it's a gorgeous, sunny, blue sky evening after a pretty gross grey day. I just had a great meeting about the events collective I started, which is Fruit Salad Events. And after this, I have 2 one-to-one client meetings, so I'm surprised at how unstressed and actually excited I feel in the middle of this squished evening. I think it's because everything feels, like really feels, to be falling into place. I'm launching something very exciting soon. I'll tell you about that at the end. That scoops up all the projects I have going on. And I am building my client base nicely. And I had a great meeting with another event organizer, and I remembered to defrost the leftover chili, so I'll be eating that tonight. Everything is going pretty good. It's the little things, you know. It's been a few weeks since I last chatted on the podcast, and I've finally finished Love in Exile by Sean Fay. My plan to finish it in a weekend was quite ambitious for me, clearly. But we got there in the end. This book is incredible. Sean Fay is so good at writing about love and all of its arms and tendrils. She's very generous with her own story and experiences, but also pulls in a lot of research without it feeling dense and too intellectual. Love in Exile is very easy to read, of course very funny, and alarmingly hopeful without being fluffy and fake. I really recommend it. You should definitely buy it or borrow it from me. I fear that this book will take up the next chunk of podcasts. As I was reading it, I was like making notes in the margins and putting in, I made like lists of page references for different topics that I want to talk about. So we'll see. Maybe I'll be talking about this book for a while. This episode, I'll be talking about the incredibly prevalent tensions and unique aspects of dating in this moment in time. This is one of the topics that I picked out of the book, what it means to be dating in the internet age. So, how did it feel to read this book? It felt like the solidification of truths that sit in the back of your mind, like things you sort of know but can't really put into words. There was some kind of friendliness or comfort or familiarity about it, though. It didn't feel like preachy or self-righteous. It was delivered with humility, which is, I don't know, it's really lovely to be received that way. It's not particularly pessimistic or optimistic. It's neutral. Is the neutral just imistic? It's very balanced, we'll say. This book frames the problem of experiencing exile from love. And though she acknowledges throughout that it isn't her transness that is the sole cause of this exile, transphobia does create complex barriers for her. This got me thinking about other aspects of identity that keep people exiled from love. Disability, race, neurodivergence, age, many other things. And all of these are based on prejudices that are amplified when you're meeting people on dating apps. All the more reason to get off dating apps. And you'll have to listen until the end of the episode to hear about a campaign I'm running to solve this issue with dating apps that we have. Okay, now to my first train of thought from Love in Exile. I'm calling it consumption of the self. So it's kind of about viewing ourselves from the outside first. And yes, this means I'm talking about social media and porn and chat rooms as something that happens alongside dating and before dating as well. So I'm going to put in some quotes. I'll try and make it obvious when I'm quoting her, but she has quite a distinctive voice, I think. So hopefully you'll be able to tell, but I'll try and do the quote unquote thing. So she says, "I am of the exact age where it was possible to have learned how to fuck exclusively online. I did so, partly, in anonymous chat rooms where, from the safety of my teenage bedroom, I could pretend to be an adult woman in highly sexual conversations with people who were adult men, people I would never meet. My early experiences of sex were so divorced from true intimacy that in adulthood I have found integrating sex with vulnerability and trust very frightening. So I never stopped pretending." And I think she's talking about what she's getting at here is a huge issue that is getting in the way for so many of us who are looking for connection, love, and intimacy. It's so hard to reconnect sex and intimacy when you've gotten used to sex coming on its own, so to speak. Experiencing sex the way she has described it, or through porn, or honestly through hookups, only provides just the sexual part and doesn't demand the vulnerability required to actually connect with another person. And it's such a headfuck to be engaging with sex and with another person even, but not get that connection and intimacy that you want so badly to come with it, to like only be getting the physical intimacy and not actually feeling connected. It can feel almost like you have a wall up, a barrier to that intimacy. And that wall is more often than not made from the fear of being vulnerable enough to connect. I think she framed this common experience so well in the book. I'm sure a lot of us have experienced sex this way to begin with, growing up with the internet. And if kind of this separation between sex and intimacy rings true for you, I really recommend you read the book and also do a bit of journaling about it. Talk to a trusted friend or a therapist about this fear of vulnerability, this separation between sex and intimacy. So what do we use sex for if not for intimacy, if not for connection? And how can this separation continue, the separation between sex and intimacy, how can that continue out of chat rooms and porn and into real life interactions with other people? Well, sex can be used for lots of things. As a buffer, as a way to prop up self-esteem, to feel validated, as a distraction. And she describes that sex for her sometimes functioned as, quote, "an unknown place of adventure and a theatre where I rehearsed old scripts, trying, with mixed success, to change the ending," end quote. Perhaps this performance element is exacerbated by the increased view we have of ourselves from the outside via social media and dating apps and other things. We can become more concerned with how something looks, how we look in that connection, how we look in the interaction, rather than actually connecting with another human. You get stuck in the space in between your mind's eye and the view of you from the outside, and that's not a place that you can connect from. Ironically, as I continue down the page, she talks about the additional harm of receiving crass COD psychology, moralis, and therapized platitudes from social media. Ironic because this is a love advice podcast. She's talking about the oversimplification of sexual behaviors and the prescriptive language. So she says, I think what's dangerous about a system of sexual astrology that interprets certain ways of having sex as signs of a person's demand for validation and self-esteem, an unsated craving for love, is not so much the observation of these impulses or motivations. The problem is more their pronunciation of them as the unambiguous and pathological reasons for your sexual behaviour. And then she says that trauma, sadness, and loneliness certainly shaped the course of my sex life, but only ever alongside about 500 motivations that all contradict each other. End quote. What I think is important about this is the way she points out how boiling everything down, or boiling somebody's sexual behaviors down into these simple explanations, takes away agency and complexity of choice when this reduction happens. And this is difficult when there's like some building wax happening, but I don't think you can hear it. So, yes, when people's sexual behaviors are reduced down to cause and effect with their history or their trauma or their sadness, their loneliness, especially when often this can be wrapped up in, you know, the experience of being in a marginalized identity, it can feel very deterministic. It can feel like very damning in a way. It's not useful to boil it all down. We have to allow people to be complex and have agency, even when there are traumas, emotions, prejudices is involved. Something else I wanted to pick at in this section is the general harm of receiving these heavy prescriptions of why you have your deep-seated issues from social media. When these things are communicated through like infographics on social media or like reels, you end up with a realization or an awareness of your own issues or your own kind of brain drama, without a soft enough landing of self-love and self-reflection and support. And this isn't that helpful. Without a gentle and safe space to receive this information, these words are liable to either be rejected or to get absorbed into your view of yourself as unalterable facts that you can use to be cruel to yourself with. Like, oh, I'm just this way because I'm so fucked up by this thing and that thing, and there's nothing I can do about it. I'm just a piece of shit, this vibe, this kind of... When you have a realization like that without a soft enough landing, it can turn in on itself. This is part of the reason why therapists let you come to these realizations yourself in the safe space that you create together, to make sure that you are... I suppose ready to realize them and supported when you do. The next part that I want to talk about is a chapter where she talks about relationships and addiction, and addictive relationships and addiction alongside relationships. So if that is not something you're up for hearing today, you can skip ahead about 5 minutes or so. So I'll start with a quote. It's impossible to write about love without writing about addiction. I often wonder whether what I have in the past called love may have been closer to addiction. Fantasy had always provided me with a similar kind of escape to drinking. And then in another paragraph, she says, I may never again be as obliviously happy, as high, as I was those weeks when I was only falling in love and drinking, becoming infatuated and drinking. For years, those were my two favourite things, because for me, they were essentially the same thing. She's talking about consuming relationships, love and sex, as if they are substances, as a way to escape from the self, from life, in a similar way that you would consume alcohol. And she talks about it as a way to escape enough from life to make life bearable. She remembers consuming love and community and alcohol in this way over her life. In the beginning, this is a quote. In the beginning, drinking was a way to reach out and touch life. Nightlife as an oasis of community, friendship, sex and paid work and gender bending. Looking back, it's easy to put this down to the booze, but at the time, the fun and the friendship and my gender and the drink were indivisible. all the bad parts felt like a small price to pay for what I got out of it, because what I got seemed like love itself. And she talks about what she got from drinking and nightlife was to feel free and accepted in the club space and then be forced into self-care during a hangover. Of course, it's not that there's nothing real and connected about queer nightlife or in the love affairs that feel more like addictions. In fact, there is often genuine support, care, love, self-expression and creativity interwoven into all of these places. That's what's so hard about it. They offer escapism, but they also provide many other things that we desperately need to survive life. As she puts it, addicts need the same strength that strangles us. And for those addicted to love, this is me, that's the end of the quote. And for those addicted to love or loving in an addicted way, there is plenty of signals from society that that is totally fine and expected. There is this warped view of love sprinkled all over our culture and art, in books and songs and films, encouraging and romanticizing a deranged, excited misery, this addicted type of love. It's very exciting, this the type of thing that Lana Del Rey sings about. It's very dramatic. It makes things feel very important and meaningful. It's very dopamine-y. But it is more of an illusion than it feels. It's a fantasy. She says about a love affair that was like this, how it ended. She says, "Our mutual idolatry, each of us worshipping a false ideal of the other, had fast crumbled into ruins." End quote. Of course, this is just so much more possible when we are all used to creating and consuming avatar versions of ourselves to be consumed, to create false ideals and consume other people's false ideals. And yes, yes, the commodification of the self rears its ugly head once again, but there is more here. I think there's something important about the crumbling of those feelings, having an emotion that is so crumbly can feel so distressing when it falls away. Having something that felt strong and vital, that you pinned meaning to, fall away, creates a void, or reveals a void that can suck you into any behaviors or people that seem to fill it. She says, "Obsession is never truly about the object, it's about the gratification of the obsessed." End quote. And it makes sense that consuming love to fill the void feels necessary, feels hard, you know, filling the void so you can live your life, because it's hard to walk around the world with a void in your chest, especially a world that tends to hate you. It's a clear cycle. She talks about towards the end of this chapter, actually at the beginning of the chapter and at the end, it's a nice little bookends, very, very well written. She talks about the appearance of a metaphor into a particular obsessive addictive relationship that is almost too perfectly descriptive of the whole scenario. She talks about taking a photo in front of a painting at the National Gallery of Bacchus and Ariadne. I had to write it in phonetically so that I'd know how to say it. Ariadne. Which shows Ariadne falling in love with Bacchus. Bacchus is like the god of wine. When she was about to jump off a cliff and falling in love with him instead of doing that. She says, "A seduction by the god of wine saves her from herself." Obsession then, she says, is the very opposite of love. It's a captivating simulacrum impeding us from discovering the real thing. End quote. And from this, I have a journaling prompt for anyone who is relating too hard to this. What obsessions are keeping you captivated and impeding you from discovering love? After all, quote, "To see sex solely as an excavation of one's selfhood is to forget that we usually do it with someone else," end quote. Sex is an experience you share with someone or several people. It is a collaboration, not a performance. It requires vulnerability and to not be in control of how you are perceived at every moment. This is a concept that isn't very familiar to many of us, and certainly the dates and moments that lead up to having sex with someone for the first time can be about the exact opposite. Dating can be a process of curating and controlling how you are seen and trying to predict the other person's part rather than seeing each other and collaborating and connecting. This has been true about dating or courting for much of history. But I think the self-commodification we do in putting ourselves on dating apps accelerates this tendency to project an idea of the self. Plus, we don't live in history, we live right now, so. Oh, there is a baby crying. I hope you can't hear that. So, with the interruption of a baby crying, this is where I effortlessly slide into talking about the project I'm working on. It's called Queer IRL, as in queer in real life. Here's the vibe I'm going for. I'm just going to read you out kind of like the manifesto, I suppose. Get off dating apps for Pride Month. Why, you ask? Dating apps suck, and nobody seems to be enjoying it. Dating apps also amplify societal prejudices. This has been seen in research. The biggest dating app company, Match Group, that owns Tinder, Hinge, Match.com, and others, a total of 46 dating apps, they made £2.7 billion last year. So I think we should put our attention and money into our community this June and find queer love where it already is, at LGBTQ+ venues and events. Luckily, there is a collective of event organisers who put on events for the LGBTQIA+ community where conversation and connection is encouraged and accessibility is prioritised, and that's Fruit Salad Events, the events collective that I have been putting together over the past year, 2 years. I'm not saying dating apps are only and always bad. They can be really efficient as a way to find people, to filter through potential partners. But for the month of Pride, give IRL a go. Another benefit of dating apps, I suppose, is that they are very accessible. I mean, they amplify ableism and other prejudices, but events can't be accessed by everyone. So I will also have a digital offering for those who can't access events, but that is still very much in the works. I will let you know about that when it's finished. I'll also be making badges and patches and stuff like that, so you can flag to other people that you are taking part in queer IRL and are in fact both queer and single or looking for love. It's a very simple design, so you can also make your own badge at home if you like. And oh, I'm so excited about this. I've put so much thought into it and I'm very excited to bring it to you all. So that's queer IRL. No dating apps for Pride Month, just meeting people at events by queer people, for queer people, events designed with conversation and connection in mind, with a focus on accessibility. So, if this sounds interesting to you, watch this space to see how you can take part in Queer IRL when June comes around. If you're an event organiser, have a look at Fruit Salad Events Collective to see if it would be a good fit for you to join. And if you're a business or a venue looking to support queer people this Pride Month, please do get in touch. Can you tell I don't know how to talk to businesses at all? To finish, I'm going to steal this idea from The White Pube. They do it. The White Pube is a team of two art critics, I suppose. It's gone way beyond art criticism at this point. There was a review of Going to the Dentist and a review of Going to the Bingo with her mum. Anyway, amazing podcast, you should listen. And at the end of their podcast, they ask listeners to comment an emoji, a specific emoji, to let them know that you've listened all the way to the end. So for this episode, the emoji I would like you to post is that little phone with the red circle around it and a line through it, as in like the no phones allowed emoji. And you can put it in my Spotify comments or my Instagram. If you're very shy, you can DM it to me. I just want to know who's listening. All right, that's enough from me. Have a lovely day. Read Love in Exile by Sean Fay. And I'll chat to you next time. Bye.